Greetings to all those on the webcast. Hello to all of you here as well. I have a question for all of you and for myself. Are you faithful? To begin today, please turn to Genesis chapter 12 and verses 1 through 12. Or not 12, 22. Genesis chapter 22. 12 would be a very different story. In all of our lives, there are pivotal moments. Moments that show what we're made of. Moments that show what's really most important to us. Moments that can show just how faithful we are. And if we're willing to take a good, honest look at them, it's in those moments that we learn the most about ourselves. Today, let's see what we can learn from a closer look at the pivotal moment in the life of the father of the faithful. Genesis 22 and verse 1. Now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Take now your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac, his son. And he split the wood from the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. And on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, Stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you. So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together. But Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, My father. And he said, Here I am, my son. Then he said, Look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, My son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. So the two of them went together. Then they came to the place which God had told him, and Abraham built an altar there and placed the wood in order and bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. So he said, Here I am. And he said, Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son from me. Now I know. That's a puzzling statement. Doesn't God know everything? He knows your heart. So didn't God already know that Abraham feared him? Well, now that we've read the end of the story, let's go back and look at what came before this for the answer. Please turn to Genesis chapter 12. And verses 1 through 3. Now, I will say, as we look into the question of what God did or did not know, that when God says something, we do well to take him at his word. So when God says, "Now I know," he means it. But I think we'll find some lessons for us by taking a deeper look at how an all-knowing God, one who can read your heart and your mind, comes to the point where he can say, "Now I know." Genesis 12 and verse 1. "Now the Lord said to Abram, 'Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house. Go to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.' So Abram departed, as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran." This is the first promise to Abraham, or to Abram in this case, recorded in the Bible. God says, "Leave your home and your family, and I'll bless you." And Abram packs up and goes. He takes his wife, his nephew, all their stuff, all their servants, and they travel a long way from home. Then, drop down to verse 7. "Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, 'To your descendants I will give this land.' And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him." Now the implication is there in verse 2 when God says he'll make Abram a great nation. But here in verse 7 it's made clear. God promises to give this new land to Abram's descendants. Now the old King James translates this word as seed. So we have a very clear promise from God that Abram will have offspring, a child or children. But, a very big three-letter word, let's look at verses 11 through 10 through 13. "Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass, when he was close to entering Egypt, that he said to Sarai, his wife, 'Indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance.'" When they get there, Sarai is going to turn heads, and Abram knows it. "Therefore, it will happen when the Egyptians see you that they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me. But they will let you live. Please say you are my sister, that I may be well, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you." God says to Abram, "Go, get up and go." Abram clearly believes God because he got up and went. God promises you're going to have a family big enough to fill the land of Canaan, and they'll be a great nation. But here he is. No children yet, no descendants. God hasn't fulfilled the promise yet. So why is he afraid for his life? He's afraid enough that he lies about Sarai being his wife and asks her to lie for him. There's a chink in Abraham's armor. Now, you probably know the rest of the story. Pharaoh does notice Sarai and brings her into his palace along with her brother, Abram. With some help from God, Pharaoh finds out that Sarai is Abraham's wife and says, "You lied to me. Take your wife and get out of here." Now, let's go to chapter 13 and verses 14 through 17. "Now Now, Abram now is very rich, it says. And so is Lot at this point. In fact, the two of them are so rich that they can't keep all their stuff in one house. They need to go their separate ways so that their animals have enough room. And Abram gives Lot first pick. And Lot picks what looks like the better deal. And then in verse 14 of Genesis 13, "And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, 'Lift your eyes now and look, for the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward, for all the land which you see, I give to you and your descendants forever.'" Same word as before, descendants are seed, offspring. "And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants also could be numbered. Arise, walk in the land through its length and its width, for I give it to you." God makes the promise again, only he expands on it a little bit more. Not only is his family going to inherit the land, but you're going to have more offspring than there is dirt. If you're counting, that's three times God has made the promise to Abram. First, when he was in Haran, second, when he got to Canaan, and now the third time when he comes back from Egypt. I'll go over to chapter 15 of Genesis. We'll read verses 1 through 8. In chapter 14, Lot is taken captive in a war between several kings. Abram goes and rescues Lot, and all of Lot's, and gets and rescues him and all of his stuff that was taken. And we're introduced to Melchizedek, the priest of God Most High, to whom God pays, or to whom Abraham pays his tithe. And then, chapter 15 and verse 1. "After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Abram, for I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward.' But Abram said, 'Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless? And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus.'" It seems Abraham is not so sure about those promises from God. Then Abram said, "Look, you have given me no offspring, no seed," the same word. "Indeed, one born in my house is my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him saying, 'This one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir.' Then he brought him outside and said, 'Look now toward heaven and count the stars, if you are able to number them.' And he said to him, 'So shall your descendants, your seed, your offspring be.'" Now I see no reason to think that Abraham, or Abram here, was confused about what God meant when he said descendants previously. But in case we're wondering if anything has been lost in translation, it should be clear to us now. Abraham's descendants, who will become a great nation, who will inherit the land of Canaan, will be so numerous they can't even be counted. These are biological offspring. Verse 6, "And he believed in the Lord, and he accounted it to him for righteousness." This verse is referenced three times in the New Testament as the example of faith. So this belief that Abram has is a big deal. Verse 7, "Then he said to him, 'I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to inherit.' And he said, 'Lord God, how shall I know that I will inherit it?'" Abram's been through a lot. at this point already. So in one sense, it's not surprising for him to ask this question, even though this is now the fourth time God has made the promise. And I'm certainly not going to pretend that I would have done better, because nowhere in the Bible does it say, wait till Matt gets here, then you'll see some real faith. But it is interesting that this question comes just two verses after he believed God, and it was accounted to him as righteousness. But God doesn't fault Abraham either. God goes through a covenant ceremony with him so that Abram will have proof of the promise. God shows Abram that his descendants will go away into a strange land and that they'll be enslaved. But he tells him, don't worry, I'm going to bring them back home. And then in verse 15 of Genesis 15. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. Each time God makes his promise to Abram, he adds a little more. More detail. More reassurance. Obviously, Abram is no spring chicken. He was already 75 when this whole thing started. But God tells him, you're going to be a good old age when you die. And you're going to die in peace. Now, at this point, Abram seems to be in pretty good shape. Four times God has made the promise, and we even have this declaration that Abram believed God. He had faith. But now, let's look at chapter 16, in verses 1 through 3. Abram and Sarai get one of those ideas in their heads. One of those, I know what God says, but he must mean something else. One of those ideas. His word says, do this, but that's not realistic. Genesis 16 and verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. And she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, see now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go in to my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her. And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. Then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife. After Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. That wife you had when God made those promises, she's not really working out. So what you need to do is get a new wife. That must be what God means, right? You know what happens. Hagar, the new wife, becomes pregnant. And that, of course, led to peace and happiness in the family. No, Hagar despises Sarai, and Sarai returns the favor. And Sarai runs her off. But she comes back, and Ishmael is born. Next, let's read Genesis 17 in verses 1 through 8. Now, it's interesting, as we go there, that Ishmael is Abraham's son. But while Sarai said, I shall obtain children by her, Ishmael is never referred to as Sarai's son. This idea that Sarai had never gave her what she thought it would. Ever had something like that happen to you? When you had one of those ideas, I know what God says, but I think this is the right thing to do. If getting the thing you want means doing things the wrong way, then the thing that you want is probably wrong too. Genesis 17 and verse 1. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, "I am Almighty God. Walk before me and be blameless. And I will make my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly." If you're keeping score, that's now five times God has made his promise. Verse 3, then Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, "As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. No longer will your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham. For I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations, plural, of you. And kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you in their generations, for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants after you. Also, I give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." Again, God adds a little more depth, promising to be the God not just of Abraham, but of his descendants. And now let's jump down to verse 15 of Genesis 17. And we'll read verses 15 through 18. Then God said to Abraham, "As for your wife Sarai, or as for Sarai your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. For I will bless her and also give you a son by her." That idea you guys had, that's not the plan. "Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall be from her." Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, "Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 99 years old, bear a child?" And Abraham said to God, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you." Five times God has made his promise to Abraham, and despite Abraham's faith, he still has trouble believing. Turn to Genesis chapter 20 and verses 10 and 11. In chapter 19, God comes to Abraham again and says, "You and Sarah are going to have a son." And after Sarah laughs this time, God gives the reminder that nothing is too hard for God. Then comes a familiar story. They travel south, and Abraham says to Abimelech, "Sarah is my sister." Again, with some help from God, Abimelech finds out the truth. And then in Genesis chapter 20 and verse 10, "Then Abimelech said to Abraham, 'What did you have in view that you have done this thing? What were you thinking?' he says. And Abraham said, 'Because I thought surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife.'" And he goes on to say, "Well, technically, she is my sister." He goes with the whole half-truth defense, meaning the other half is a lie. And when it comes to God's standard for honesty, the half-lie is the only half that matters. But We've got six times the promise has been made from God. Assurances that his descendants will be a great nation, more numerous than can be counted. A promise of inheritance, two times specifically, promise that Isaac will be born to Sarah, which hasn't happened yet. And a promise that Abraham will die in peace at an old age. And yet, we've got Abraham lying about Sarah again, because he's worried about being killed. We've got him taking matters into his own hands and having Ishmael with Hagar. We've got Abraham questioning God. God, that's impossible. God says he's going to fulfill his promise through a son that will be born to his beautiful wife, Sarah, who's still turning heads at 90 years old. And Abraham says, no, God, use Ishmael. Then, after Isaac comes, finally, God says, kill him and burn him for me. Which brings us back to where we started. Now, I realize we covered a lot of ground there, and in case you're wondering, no, it wasn't to show you that Abraham is actually a terrible example of faith. But when we ask the question, didn't God already know that Abraham feared him, that Abraham would follow him, it should become pretty clear to us at this point that there was a legitimate reason for God to be unsure. Please turn to Hebrews 11 and verses 8 through 15. And save your place here in Genesis. Yes, God knows the heart. He knows us better than we know ourselves. He knows what we're thinking. But if God already knows what you're going to do in any given situation, if God already knew that Abraham would go through with the command to sacrifice Isaac, then what's the point of this life? Why do we even have to live it? Hebrews 11 and verse 8. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. By faith, Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. These all died in faith, it says, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them. God assured Abraham of the promise over and over again, embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. It was always Abraham's choice whether he would obey or turn back. God gave Abraham the choice. He's given every human being who has ever lived the choice. He even gives the angels the choice. And sometimes Abraham didn't obey. Sometimes we don't obey. God created perfect angels, and even some of them chose not to obey. God didn't make the choice for them. They had to make it. Abraham had to make it. And we have to make the choice over and over again. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verses 1 and 2. Now, we might be tempted to think that it should have been easier for Abraham. He had God, in this case, the one who became Jesus Christ, telling him directly, this is going to happen. Moses spoke to God face to face, it says, but he still fell down. The apostles followed Jesus Christ, God in the flesh, for 3.5 years. And at the end, they bickered about positions. And they still ran off when the soldiers came for Christ. In the middle of a trial, have you ever thought or even said to God, if you'd just tell me what to do, I'd do it. If you would just talk to me the way you talk to them, I'd listen. I'd believe you. I've thought that. Yes, Abraham and Moses and the apostles all had God speaking to them directly. But they didn't have everything that we have. Abraham didn't have this book to open whenever he had a question. Whenever he had doubts and fears pop up, Moses and the apostles only had parts of it. When they went through those moments, they didn't have a church family to love and encourage them. Who could Abraham ask for prayers or go to for advice after services? Who encouraged Moses? Moses was questioned and accused constantly. What are you doing? Why did you bring us here? You're not trying to help. You're trying to kill us. Yes, they had God speaking to them directly, which should be an unbelievable source of strength. But they were also asked to do things that you and I have never been asked to do. Was it easier that way? When God gives more, he expects more. But whatever God does, he does for a reason. Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 1. Every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe, that you may live and multiply, and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham. And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness, to humble you and test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. God tested Israel so he could know whether they would follow him. God tested Abraham so he could know whether he would follow him. And God tests us so that he can know whether we will follow him, whether we will always keep his commandments, or whether there will come a day that we will choose not to. The question for you and me is there anything in your life that you're not willing to give up for God? Anything you might choose over God. Your home, your family, how about your freedom or your health? How about those thoughts that bounce around in your head and my head? Are we willing to give those up? Will we sacrifice those to God if he asks? Or will we hold on tight to some of those things? If I can't have this, then I give up. Have you or I reached that point with God yet where he can say, "Now I know"? Let's go back to Genesis chapter 22 and look at another statement to see something else that we can learn in verses 4 and 5. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 4. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey, and the lad and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you." Now, I don't know if this is true for you, but it is for me. For a long time, whenever I read this part of Genesis, probably because I know the end of the story, I would read right through this statement by Abraham without giving it much thought. But it's worth serious consideration. We will come back to you. Did Abraham really mean this? Or was he just saying it because he didn't want his servants or Isaac to know what was going on? Let's go back to Hebrews 11 again and read verses 17 through 19. And as we go through the Bible, there are times when there are details seemingly left out. And we'd like to know what those details are. What the Bible, doesn't say. When you're going through a trial and you read the story of Joseph looking for some encouragement, does it ever happen? But if we read through that in the context of our own trials, don't you start to wonder, what was Joseph thinking the whole time? Now, personally, I think it would be helpful to know what Joseph was thinking while he was in prison. After he interpreted the dreams of the butler and the baker, when he seemed so close to getting out, only to have to wait 2 more years. But would it help to know that Joseph was rock solid in his faith and never wavered? Or would it make him seem superhuman and unrelatable to us? Would seeing his weak moments help us believe that we can get through those moments when our faith isn't as strong as it should be? Or would it just lead us to think less of Joseph and discount his example? Or maybe even lead us to think too highly of ourselves. I can't believe how little trust he had in God. I wouldn't do that. The bottom line is the Bible doesn't say. And our speculations may not be as helpful as we may think. There's about 4,000 years of the history of God's servants recorded in this book. And it just can't answer all the questions that pop into our heads. No matter how many of answers you could get to those unanswerable questions, you would always be left with more questions. We have to trust that if it's important for us to have the answer, God made sure it got written in the book. And in this case, I believe it's pretty clear that God did just that. Hebrews 11, verses 17 through 19. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, "In Isaac your seed shall be called." Now Abraham had another son, and we know that. And even though God blessed Ishmael, and even though Abraham loved both, when it comes to God's plan, and when it came to how God and Abraham viewed them, the two sons were not on the same level. Isaac was the only son that God had promised. He was the only son that God chose. And the Bible bears that out in other places. He who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, "In Isaac your seed shall be called," concluding that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. Did Abraham mean it when he said, "We will come back to you"? It should be pretty clear that he did. And I think there are a couple of important things that for us to take from that. First, Abraham did not expect God to call it off. The Bible doesn't tell us what Abraham was thinking the whole time. But as they walked for 3 days, as he and Isaac went up the mountain, as he tied Isaac up and put him on the altar, and even as Abraham raised that knife, Abraham did not expect to hear that voice that said, "Abraham, Abraham, do not lay your hand on the lad." And I'm sure he was very relieved. But notice the difference. Over the course of 25 years, Abraham was given multiple promises, specific promises, and yet there were times when, in the circumstances of the moment, Abraham didn't fully believe. Times when he lied out of fear. Times when he took the matter into his own hands. But now, when God said, "I want you to take this son that I promised you, the one you waited for all those years, and I want you to kill him," Abraham believed God. And Abraham's expectation was that God meant what he said. The second thing to take from this is Abraham now believed God enough to draw a different conclusion than what made sense to human reasoning. Contrast these two moments in Abraham's life. We already read about the birth of Ishmael, so we won't go back there, but you can jot down Genesis 16 in your notes if you want for reference. When they were still childless, years after God made his first promises, Abraham and Sarah looked at the circumstances, and when things hadn't gone the way they expected, they came up with their own conclusion. God must have meant this. God didn't say, "Have a child with another woman," but that was the conclusion that made sense to them. They believed God, but not all the way. Not quite enough to take him at his word. But now, God says, "Take Isaac and sacrifice him." And not only does Abraham believe that when God says, "I have to do this, I have to do this," but he also believed that God would still keep his promise. God promised me that many nations would come from Isaac. So that means many nations will come from Isaac. So if God says to take his life, then that must mean that God will give it back to him. Hebrews 11 makes it clear that Abraham knew that this physical life was not all there is. We don't know when he reached that point, but I don't see anything in the Bible that should lead us to conclude anything other than that. Abraham expected he would sacrifice Isaac on that mountain, and then they would both come back alive. Please turn to James chapter 5 and verses 12 through 15. Sorry, 13 through 15. Now, God is not speaking to us directly, telling us to sacrifice our children. In fact, he makes it very clear later on in the Bible that he does not like that kind of sacrifice. So, Isaac, you can breathe easy. So, let's put this lesson in terms that are applicable to us. James chapter 5 and verse 13. Is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing psalms. Is anyone among you sick? Let him call for the elders of the church and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of faith will save the sick, and the Lord will raise him up. We follow this instruction. When someone in the church is sick, they can call an elder for anointing. And God does heal. Sometimes. There was a time in the church when the conclusion was, if someone isn't healed physically, when they are anointed, then they don't really have faith. I'm not saying everybody believed that, but it was widespread, and maybe some of you remember that time. But it says, right here, the prayer of faith will save the sick. So if you're not healed, it's because of a lack of faith. But whose faith? The faith of the sick person? Or the faith of the person who made the prayer? The elder? Well, let's take a look at something. The word translated save in the Greek is the word sozo. And according to Thayer, sozo means to save, to keep safe and sound, to rescue from danger or destruction. And it can mean, as it says, to save a suffering one from perishing, from disease, to make well, heal, or restore health. But it can also mean, as Thayer puts it, to save in the technical biblical sense, to deliver from the penalties of the messianic judgment. To put it in our terms, sozo can mean to save from eternal death. It also says here in James, the Lord will raise him up. The word for raise or raise up here is egero. It means to arouse, cause to rise, to arouse from sleep, to awake. This word is used in Matthew 9 as Jesus heals the lame man and says, arise and walk. It can also mean to arouse from the sleep of death, to recall the dead to life. The word egero is used in 1 Corinthians 15, referring to, repeatedly, the resurrection of Christ and the saints, not just to physical life, but to immortality. And then, of course, there's that last sentence in verse 15, which I stop short of on purpose. And if he has committed sins, he will be forgiven. Now we're definitely talking about something different than healing from disease or some other health condition. Turn to Matthew 10 and verses 16 through 22. When you put saving the sick in the context of sin and forgiveness, that's a different kind of sickness, a different kind of saving. It's a much more important kind of saving. Matthew 10 and verse 16. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Our understanding of the evils of this world is not licensed to behave in kind. Our standard of behavior, our standard of speech, is the standard of Jesus Christ. Beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. You will be brought before governors and kings for my sake, he says, as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, do not worry about how or what you should speak, for it will be given to you in that hour what you should speak. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. Now brother will deliver up brother to death, and father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake. But he who endures to the end will be saved. There can be no trial in this life that causes us to give up on God's promises. However difficult a financial trial, a relationship trial, or even a health trial, whatever God may ask you and me to sacrifice, this is the saving that is most important. Do we trust God and his promises like Abraham did? Will we believe that God will keep his promises even if it seems impossible? Will we trust his solution and not our own? Whatever happens, will we do what God asks? Will we do what God asks, and we will come back to you? Let's go back to Genesis 22 and verses 1 through 3 to look at one last thing. Now, Abraham was special to God. Throughout his life, he followed God. His faithfulness is an example for all of us. And the entire world has been blessed because of the faithfulness of that one man. But he wasn't perfect. There were times in his life when his faith faltered. But at this pivotal moment in Abraham's life, he proved himself to be faithful. Even as he faced his ultimate test, willing to make the same sacrifice that God the Father would make himself, Genesis 22 and verse 1. Now it came to pass, after these things, that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son. And he split the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place which God had told him. He rose early in the morning. Abraham obeyed immediately. As Abraham went through this test, he didn't become faithful at the end. Abraham was faithful the whole time. Faithful at the end and faithful at the beginning. Turn finally to James, chapter 2 and verses 14 through 23. Abraham believed God. Three times that verse is referenced in the New Testament. And as James points out, Abraham's belief, his faith, was not just something that he held inside. Real faith is not a feeling or some vague idea. Real faith is proven by our actions, by our obedience to God. James 2 and verse 14. What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, Depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? If all you do is send them away with a feeling, what good have you done for him? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. It's useless. But someone will say, You have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. You believe there is one God, you do well. Even the demons believe and tremble. If we believe in God but fail to live by his standards, that puts us on the same level as the demons. But do you want to know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead? Was not Abraham, our father, justified by works when he offered Isaac, his son, on the altar? Do you see that faith was working together with his works? And by works, faith was made perfect. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. And he was called a friend of God. Abraham believed in Genesis 15. But his belief was perfected. It was completed in Genesis 22. With his consistent and immediate obedience. For every servant of God, every follower of Jesus Christ, there will come a time when we will face our ultimate test. That moment when we can prove to God that we will follow, and nothing will come between him and us. That moment when God can say of you and of me, Now I know.